the CBS News Weekend Roundup in 60 seconds.
Are you hiring but not sure where to find the best candidates? As a business owner, I can tell you that your company is only as good as the people you hire. I can also tell you that posting your job in one place isn't enough to find quality candidates. But when you're short-staffed, there's no time to deal with the dozens of different job sites. Until now. Thanks to ZipRecruiter.com, I can post to 100-plus job sites with one single click and have the highest possible chance of finding that perfect candidate. Just post once, and within 24 hours, watch your candidates roll in to ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. ZipRecruiter has been used by over 300,000 businesses, and you can try it right now for free. Getting the right people for your company is so important. Try ZipRecruiter and get your perfect candidate before they go to somebody else. Today, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/deal. That's ZipRecruiter.com/deal. Again, ZipRecruiter.com/deal.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup, a wrap-up of the week with background and analysis from the correspondents who cover the news. And now from Washington, here's CBS News national correspondent Dan Revie.
The biggest recall of a consumer product turning into a logistical nightmare for the auto industry. We'll report on the Takata airbags, blamed for at least six deaths. Now almost 34 million cars and trucks in the U.S. will be called in for replacement parts. Until then, some drivers feel there might be a danger in the car. Later, the arrest of a man accused of murdering four people in a mansion here in the nation's capital. You'll hear CBS's Wyatt Andrews report.
The arrest ended a manhunt that stretched up the East Coast from Washington to Brooklyn, New York.
Also, the violent battle to the death in a restaurant in Waco, Texas. Who were those bikers? And a report on David Letterman's retirement. On his last show, reacting to all the praise.
I can't tell you how flattering, embarrassing, and gratifying it has all been.
Those stories and a lot more on this weekend roundup. First, the huge recall to be paid for by the Japanese company that makes more vehicle airbags than anyone else, Takata. Under pressure from federal safety regulators, the company now admits there's a defect, and that's why almost 1% of airbag inflators that have been tested explode. And when drivers and passengers have been hit by flying metal, at least six have died. Many more have been injured. Here's CBS News correspondent Jeff Glore with the first details this past Tuesday.
It's fair to say this is probably the most complex consumer safety recall in U.S. history.
After months of prodding, Transportation Secretary Anthony Fox said Takata finally gave in, agreeing to this record-setting recall. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration believes that moisture from humidity leaks into the airbag's inflator, changing the properties of the chemical used to inflate the bags. When this happens, the explosive force can rupture the metal casing, sending shrapnel flying through the vehicle.
Takata still has not identified the root cause of the defect, but we cannot let that delay our actions that we're taking today.
I get more anxiety than anything is when anybody stops.
3 years ago, Angelina Sujata was driving a 2001 Honda Civic, and she was involved in a crash at just 25 miles an hour. Her Takata airbag exploded. One piece of shrapnel from inside the airbag flew out her windshield. The other ripped into her body.
I had a hole in my chest, clear enough to see the bone at the bottom.
The problem back then, no one believed her.
Americans in large numbers started typing their VIN, the vehicle identification number, into a government website, safercar.gov, to see if their vehicle is being called in for airbag or airbag inflator replacement. Jeff Glore reported Wednesday.
Car owners are confused because it's still not known exactly which vehicles are being recalled. 11 car manufacturers are involved, and the companies told us they're still waiting for details from Takata in order to determine the models of their cars, which may have the defective airbags.
Well, this is certainly approaching the worst recall situation ever.
Sean Kane is the president of the consulting company Safety Research and Strategies.
As a consumer, you're between a rock and a hard place. You've got a known safety defect that, if it manifests itself, can cause a very severe injury, and yet you can't really do anything about it short of parking your car and waiting for the parts availability.
Officials say you should return to that website, safercar.gov, during the next few weeks. Type in your VIN, check again. The recall of almost 34 million vehicles could take months, maybe years. So Mark Rosekind, the head of NHTSA, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, was asked if Americans should keep driving.
yes, people need to drive their cars, but continually be getting to their dealer to make sure it gets replaced as soon as possible. I cannot say enough times, wear your seatbelt. It's the most important thing as a safety for occupant protection. And the other is airbags save lives. We have to make sure the one in everybody's car is safe.
Statistics suggest that the danger that your airbag might explode in a car crash is outweighed almost 99-1 by the probability that your airbag would work just fine and could save your life in a crash. But Rosekind said every car owner deserves to have a safe airbag. It just can't all be done immediately. Now to Waco, Texas, where 9 people were killed in a shootout involving biker gangs at a restaurant last Sunday night. Police arrested 170 people, members of gangs known for drug dealing and violence. CBS News correspondent Steve Futterman from the scene.
It all apparently began with an uninvited biker gang crashing Sunday's gang get-together. Waco Police Sergeant Patrick Swanton.
An additional biker gang that was not invited to this meeting showed up.
That led to a confrontation in the parking lot, which resulted in someone's foot being run over. Minutes later, there was gunfire. As for the 170 bikers being held, 3 were accidentally released when their bail was mistakenly reduced from $1 million to $50,000. Warrants have been issued for their arrests. Steve Futterman, CBS News, Waco.
On Monday, the day after the bullets were flying, CBS News correspondent Vicente Arenas.
170 bikers are being held, each on $1 million bail, charged with organized crime linked to capital murder. 2 of the 5 biker gangs involved are all well known to federal authorities, mainly for trafficking meth, cocaine, and marijuana. The Cossacks are based in Texas and are said to be affiliated with the Hells Angels, the largest biker gang in the country. The Bandidos are the second largest, with nearly 3,000 members in a dozen countries.
It's about territory. It's about colors. It's about money. It's about hate. It's about violence.
Jay Dobbins is a former alcohol, tobacco, and firearms agent. He spent nearly 30 years undercover infiltrating biker gangs.
If you're familiar with how these guys think, their tools of the trade, which are guns and knives and pipes and chains, and their hatred for each other, there was nothing shocking about it. It just happened to take place on a large scale in a public venue.
It's still not clear whether it was other bikers or officers who killed the 9 who died.
From Waco now to misbehavior admitted by 5 of the world's biggest banks, paying more than $5.5 billion in fines for manipulating the foreign exchange markets. We have more from CBS's Jeff Pagaz.
Prosecutors say a group of traders at the banks discussed fixing the prices of U.S. dollars and euros in secret online chat rooms. Assistant Attorney General Bill Baer.
The dollar-euro spot market is as big as it gets. Every day, about $500 billion worth of dollars and euros are traded in this market.
According to the Justice Department, the collusion started in 2007 and lasted 5 years. Court documents show the brazenness of the traders at Barclays Bank. In 2011, one trader wrote, "We're trying to manipulate it a bit more in New York now." Another said, "If you ain't cheating, you ain't trying." 4 of the banks pleaded guilty to antitrust violations. In a written statement, Barclays CEO Anthony Jenkins said the people involved have once more brought our company and industry into disrepute. And J.P. Morgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon called the conduct a great disappointment.
The other banks pleading guilty, Citigroup and the Royal Bank of Scotland. Bank of America was not charged with a crime, but has been fined by the Federal Reserve for similar violations. Up next, the alleged mansion murderer in Washington, D.C., caught.
Stay with us on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Once again, here's correspondent Dan Rabee.
Here in Washington, D.C., the murders of a wealthy couple in their 40s with their 10-year-old son and a housekeeper had a lot of people on edge. Who were the killers, and might they strike again? Perhaps it was just one person who reportedly kept the victims as prisoners overnight, forced the delivery of a bag containing $40,000, killed them all, and set fire to the house. Police sources named a suspect on Thursday. By that night, they had captured him. Sources telling CBS News they got the name because bits of his DNA were on an unfinished pizza in the mansion. CBS's Wyatt Andrews reported Friday morning.
1 week after 3 members of the wealthy and popular Savopoulos family along with their housekeeper, who was due to retire to El Salvador, were all killed in the family home. The prime suspect is now in custody.
Late Thursday night, a joint task force headed by the U.S. Marshals Service located and arrested 34-year-old Darren Dillon Wendt in Northeast Washington. They had been tracking Wendt as he traveled in a white Chevrolet. He was following a box truck driven by friends who were also arrested.
We got to a situation where we could successfully take him down, and we did our standard practiced vehicle pin maneuver, and we were able to safely pin the vehicles, both vehicles, and place them under arrest.
The arrest ended a manhunt that stretched up the East Coast from Washington to Brooklyn, New York. Police would not say if Wendt acted alone, but they did say this crime was targeted. Wendt had worked for Sava Savopoulos at the family-owned steel company American Iron Works.
We have now established that there is some specific connection between the suspect and the victims here, so this was not random.
That statement by Police Chief Kathy Lanier somewhat reassuring to the neighbors. You heard the U.S. Marshals Service was in charge of locating and arresting the murder suspect. CBS News correspondent Barry Bagnato got a firsthand account from Commander Rob Fernandez, a U.S. Marshal with the Fugitive Finding Team.
We started work in the case when the D.C. Police Department, Major Crimes Branch, were able to identify a suspect, which they did an outstanding job. It's amazing to me that how quickly they were able to identify him. We were able to determine through all-day investigation that he was more than likely in Brooklyn, New York. And so task force members went to a location where we directed them, but Wendt had fled. We believe that he saw himself on the news when it was released, and he fled the area. So we just missed him by minutes. Then we spent the rest of the day trying to figure out where he might be heading to and where he was going. You know, we're conducting surveillances and interviews and database searches and other investigative techniques, and we were able to determine that he was in a hotel in College Park, Maryland. So we had an advance team there, and they noticed that he was more than likely in one of two vehicles that were in the parking lot. We surveilled and tailed the vehicles for a few miles. We formulated a plan en route, and we were going to take both vehicles down. We conducted what we call a vehicle pin, and were able to arrest everyone involved. There was four males and two females.
The early word from police here in Washington, only Wendt charged with murder. He was an immigrant from Guyana 15 years ago. His parents brought him here when he was 19. Wendt had been arrested several times in Maryland for assault and other crimes, many traffic violations. For a short period, he was in the U.S. Marine Corps. Now, the mystery of the Amtrak crash in Philadelphia on May 12th that killed eight passengers. The engineer's lawyer insists Brandon Bostian remembers nothing unusual. As for circular damage on the front windshield, is that important? Robert Sumwalt of the National Transportation Safety Board said on CBS's Face the Nation.
I've seen the fracture pattern. It looks like something about the size of a grapefruit, if you will, and it did not even penetrate the entire windshield.
So it wasn't a bullet that hit the windshield of the Amtrak train, but maybe it was a rock, a boulder, something else that was thrown by somebody. That's still a maybe. And what difference would it have made? We turn to CBS News transportation correspondent Chris Van Cleve. What's the theory? I mean, let's say a rock hit the front of the train. Why would that make it accelerate so much? It was going at twice the speed limit on that curve.
The rock itself would not have caused the train to go that fast. Obviously, something inside the cab accelerated the train. But you could create a situation where you have an engineer who is relatively inexperienced on that area, on that route. He'd only been doing Washington, D.C. to New York for less than 3 weeks, who had heard from another engineer just moments before that he may have been shot at. Then you're accelerating, doing 60, 70 miles an hour, which is the speed limit in that area.
Kind of normal as you're leaving the Philadelphia station.
Right. And then you have an impact on your windshield. That's going to make a terrific amount of noise, whether it was a rock or something else. You hit it at 70 miles an hour, that's going to make a lot of noise. So it is conceivable that the engineer then sort of loses situational awareness because he's just been, you know, frightened and caught off guard by this thing striking the windshield, and the train continues to accelerate.
Instead of doing what might be normal, the curve's coming up ahead, and he probably has to slow down a little bit, but losing situational awareness. So that makes me think distracted by maybe the loud noise of something hitting the windshield.
Right. Or did it create a panic response? I mean, those are things that the investigators are going to try to figure out. But, you know, this train accelerated over 100 miles an hour in about 40 seconds. So you don't have to be distracted all that long for this train to get going really fast, and it's going to take it a quarter mile to safely stop that train. So, you know, once the train had started going that fast in a relatively short amount of time, it's going to take a lot of time to stop it.
As for the cause of the crash, we won't know that in weeks or even a few months.
Probably a year. NTSB investigations typically take many, many months, up to 12 months in this case. You know, we know that they have not ruled out mechanical failure yet. Obviously, a lot of focus is on the engineer and the actions inside that locomotive. But at this point, we still don't know why that train was going so fast approaching that curve.
That's CBS News transportation correspondent Chris Van Cleve. Thank you, Chris.
Sure thing.
Now the oil spill in Southern California. CBS News correspondent Ben Tracy reported from Goleta, just west of Santa Barbara.
The oil slick now stretches for 9 miles. Containment vessels are trying to stop it from spreading while dozens of hand crews work the beaches bagging up oil-contaminated sand. The onshore oil pipeline ruptured Tuesday afternoon, possibly leaking 105,000 gallons of crude, according to its owner, Plains All American Pipeline. Darren Palmer is its district manager.
We're sorry that this accidental release has happened, and we are bringing in all the resources at our disposal to respond.
Federal regulators indicate they are not satisfied by the pipeline operator's safety record. They do say this spill is not nearly as bad as a mammoth oily mess in 1969 that led to new laws and regulations. CBS's Steve Futterman went to the scene Thursday.
We are beginning to see the impact of the oil spill. Dead fish are being recovered on the oil-covered beaches, and efforts are being made to save the lives of at least five pelicans found covered in oil. Mark Crossland is with the California Department of Fish and Wildlife.
They're stable. They're going to begin that washing process.
What's the prognosis?
Depends on how heavily oiled they are.
Ocean currents are pushing the oil away from the beaches. Steve Futterman, CBS News, Goleta, California.
Up next, David Letterman's farewell.
Stay with us on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
Listen to everything from full-length news magazine programs like 60 Minutes to bite-sized features like the new Talking Animals show. They're all just a click away. Get CBS Radio News podcasts from iTunes, Stitcher, and AHA.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Once again, here's correspondent Dan Rabee.
The TV ratings were huge for David Letterman's last late show on CBS this past Wednesday night. 13.8 million people were watching. On the CBS World News Roundup, which is on the radio and podcasts every weekday morning, Steve Kathan reported,
it's the late show with David Letterman.
David Letterman wrapped up his record 33-year career on late-night TV with the final CBS Late Show, a send-off that featured presidential proclamations.
Our long national nightmare is over.
Our long national nightmare is over.
Our long national nightmare is over.
Our long national nightmare is over. Letterman is retiring.
Ladies and gentlemen, here's tonight's Top 10.
Big stars told us the top 10 things they always wanted to say to Dave. There was Seinfeld star Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
Thanks for letting me take part in another hugely disappointing series finale.
Bill Murray at number one.
I'll never have the money I owe you.
Oh, no. There's nothing.
A revved-up audience witnessed the end of an era.
It was like moving. It was energetic.
It was so touching. It was wonderful.
I've never seen such a humble man in my life.
Letterman's own farewell was touching after more than 6,000 broadcasts.
People have been saying lovely things about us, and it's really been over the top. And I can't tell you how flattering, embarrassing, and gratifying it has all been.
The Late Show will be back on CBS starting in September with a new host, Stephen Colbert. CBS This Morning broadcast from a new tourist attraction in New York City, the Observation Deck at the top of One World Trade Center, a new skyscraper built right alongside the memorial to the thousands of people killed in the terrorist attack on the original Trade Center Twin Towers on 9/11 almost 14 years ago. And for CBS This Morning, Nora O'Donnell came to Washington. She interviewed the new Attorney General, Loretta Lynch. A longtime federal prosecutor, she's the first African-American woman to hold that job. One subject, the death of Freddie Gray, an unarmed man in Baltimore. While in police custody, six officers are to go on trial for that.
Your first day on the job, you were dealing with what was going on in Baltimore.
Yes.
I mean, within a couple of hours, you had an unscheduled meeting with the President of the United States about what to do next.
People have asked me about that, and they've said, you know, you immediately had to deal with Baltimore. And that's true. But people in Baltimore have been dealing with those issues for years.
And not just Baltimore. I mean, we've had Ferguson, we've had Cleveland, we've had North Charleston. What's going on in this country?
I think that what you have seen in some cities and the resulting publicity has highlighted instances of tension and frustration and negative relationships that have gone on for a while. And you'll talk to community leaders who will say, we've been telling you this for years, but no one was listening. So it's hard to say whether it's a new phenomenon or we're just paying more attention to it.
But Madam Attorney General, since you're the chief law enforcement official in America, is it individual racism or do you think it's institutional racism?
You know, I think that when you look at America, and for all of its glory and all the wonderful things that it achieves, it's clear that we still have issues involving race in this country.
Another big topic for Attorney General Lynch, the expiration at the end of this month of the National Security Agency's authority to collect metadata about every phone call made in this country as a counterterrorism measure. Lynch hoping Congress would extend that authorization.
I'm hoping that the more we have discussion on this point, the more clarity we can provide to the American people about exactly what we do with that data, what's called metadata. It's information about telephone calls. It's not the content. It's not what's being said.
But if that law expires on June 1st, and you don't have the ability to collect that metadata, what's your biggest fear?
Our biggest fear is that we will lose important eyes on people who have made it clear that their mission is to harm American people here and abroad.
You think it makes America less safe?
I think that we run the risk of essentially being less safe.
Attorney General Loretta Lynch on CBS This Morning. Now you'll hear a message distributed by the head of the Boy Scouts of America, the former Defense Secretary and CIA Chief Robert Gates, who says the Boy Scouts have to lift the ban on homosexuals as adult leaders.
I truly fear that any other alternative will be the end of us as a national movement. We cannot ignore growing internal challenges to our current membership policy from some councils, like the Greater New York Council, the Denver Area Council, and others, in open defiance of the policy.
The Boy Scouts lifted a ban on gay youth 2 years ago. In the Middle East, troubling news for the U.S. and its allies as the terrorist army known as ISIS made significant gains in both Iraq and Syria. They captured a city called Palmyra, sometimes called Palmyra, from Syria's army. That area chock full of archaeological sites. In Iraq, government troops abandoned vehicles and weapons that the U.S. had provided. Now ISIS has them in the capital of Anbar province, Ramadi. CBS News correspondent David Martin spoke with a former U.S. officer who fought in Anbar province, where 1,300 American troops lost their lives in the Iraq War.
When Vijay Tedesco led a task force of 1,000 men and women into Ramadi in the spring of 2006, it was probably Iraq's most dangerous city.
There was nothing but al-Qaeda in Iraq. They had created a very dense and very sophisticated defense in depth, using massive amounts of IEDs and everything else.
Now retired, Tedesco says his task force lost 14 tanks, but tanks can be replaced.
In 9 months in Ramadi, we lost 17 soldiers, Marines, and sailors operating in my task force or in the areas I controlled, and we had more than 100 wounded.
Sergeant Terry Lisk was killed by a mortar round, Sergeant Nicholas Gibbs by a sniper. But after 9 months of fighting, they had something to show for their sacrifice.
When we left in February of 2007, there were areas of the city that you could move freely about in that were unimaginable 9 months before that.
Now those hard-won gains have been wiped away by the inability of Iraqi troops backed by American airstrikes to stand up to ISIS, the successor to al-Qaeda in Iraq.
When you talk to soldiers in your battalion who were wounded, what do they say now?
There's a lot of bitterness and a lot of pain.
Tedesco himself feels a tangle of emotions, sadness, resignation, and anger.
Just legitimate anger.
Anger at?
And this is going to sound terrible, but frankly at politicians, both here and in Iraq.
On Memorial Day, Tedesco is going to Arlington National Cemetery to stand at the grave of Specialist Andrew Dahl.
I'm going to run into the mothers of other men and women, many of whom died in Ramadi and Anbar about the same time, who were buried around him. And it's going to be hard this year.
Tedesco lost 17 in his task force. A total of 83 Americans were killed in Ramadi during the time he was there. David Martin, CBS News, The Pentagon.
Please follow us on Twitter for the latest headlines at CBS Radio News. And I'm at Dan Raviv.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup, a wrap-up of the week with the correspondents who cover the news. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Once again, here's Dan Raviv.
The ODNI, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, called it Osama bin Laden's bookshelf, releasing the other day about 100 documents found in the al-Qaeda leader's secret home in Pakistan, where U.S. Navy SEALs found him and shot him dead 4 years ago this month. There were letters in Arabic to one of his wives, to his kids, and to al-Qaeda activists in several countries. CBS News correspondent Mark Phillips reports.
Among the files, memos to his followers saying the focus should be on killing and fighting the American people, not attacking Arab regimes. Also among the files was an al-Qaeda job application. Among the questions, do you wish to execute a suicide operation, and who shall we contact in case you become a martyr?
This release also listed books that bin Laden had in digital form to read on his computer, a book about the Obama administration by Bob Woodward, and books even more critical of U.S. foreign policy, some of them based on conspiracy theories. CBS News national security analyst Juan Zarate.
They clearly wanted to understand the fissures in the system, that is to say, the vulnerabilities the United States has. And so the reading list doesn't surprise me. The reality is bin Laden, Ayman al-Zawahiri, who now leads al-Qaeda, reads what is written in the West. They listen to what we say and certainly try to use our vulnerabilities against us.
Bin Laden's book collection also included the official report of the 9/11 Commission. Now our Weekend Roundup commentator, Charles Grodin.
With all the talk from the various people who are exploring whether they should run for president or not, and all the going back and forth about who said what and when about going into Iraq, my mind goes to a young Marine lying in a coffin. Charlie and his buddy, who lived in Connecticut, were home on leave preparing to go from Iraq to Afghanistan, and on any given night they might understandably have had too much to drink. Charlie was sitting in the front seat and his buddy was behind the wheel when the car went into a tree. The buddy walked away unharmed while Charlie wouldn't be walking anywhere. I too often feel that those who are discussing this don't really have sufficiently front and center what it is to put young people in that situation. My wife and I went to a gathering on an anniversary of Charlie's death. My wife asked the Marine who was there what it was like over there. The Marine had a kind of a fixed look in his eyes when he said, "They shoot at you, you shoot at them."
That from Charles Grodin. It's not as simple as that, demonstrated in a criminal courtroom in London, where a British taxi driver who went to Iraq, he said, to help some friends, was convicted of murder for making bombs in Iraq, including one that killed a U.S. Army sergeant 8 years ago. Here's CBS News correspondent Elizabeth Palmer.
IEDs, homemade bombs, turned Iraq's roads into lethal minefields for U.S. soldiers in Iraq. One of them killed 34-year-old Sergeant Randy Johnson when it went off under his armored vehicle in 2007. Fast forward 8 long years, and there's justice for Sergeant Johnson. Careful police work, forensic science, and a little bit of luck convicted Sardar of murder. Justice, too, for Specialist Joe Bacani, who was wounded trying to recover a bomb Sardar helped to build.
I could feel, like, the sun beating on me and, like, my blood, my own blood, feeling hotter than that sun. And I could feel, like, that I was losing a lot of blood.
British police flagged Sardar when he came home from the war in Iraq in 2007, not in connection with these incidents. And in 2012, they even raided his home and found a bomb-making manual. But it wasn't enough to charge him. The evidence for that came a year later. IEDs, intact and in pieces, had been collected in Iraq and shipped halfway across the world to the FBI's terrorism explosives lab in Virginia. In 2014, bingo. Sardar's prints were lifted from a piece of tape on two bombs that had been planted on the roads west of Baghdad. British police finally had what they needed to go to court.
Sardar was convicted. The mandatory sentence under British law, life in prison. Now let's examine the money-making possibilities as marijuana is increasingly legalized. Call it weed, pot, grass, whatever you want to call it. It's a way of making money and without breaking the law, or so it seems. We turn to an expert on this, George Jage. You're president of Marijuana Business Media, publisher of a new book. It's called The Marijuana Business Factbook 2015. It refers to investment opportunities. Is this just about growing and selling the marijuana, or all sorts of, you know, things that we used to find maybe we still do in a head shop?
Well, not necessarily a head shop. When we look at the marijuana industry and talk about the total economic value of the market, we estimate currently that the market value for recreational and dispensary sales of marijuana as a plant and a product and derivatives of that is currently at $3 billion in 2015. We also created a multiplier to gauge the data on what is the total economic impact of the marijuana industry. And we have a multiplier of 2.6 that really pushes the total market value of the industry at $10 billion. That's not head shop stuff. That is companies that are selling lighting equipment, extraction equipment. These are hundreds of thousands of dollars pieces of equipment. You know, indoor growing facilities. I mean, there's a lot of property, plant, and equipment infrastructure that is being put into this industry right now.
And tell me, until, well, now or a few years ago, was all of this under the radar, illegal, untaxed?
Yeah, listen, Dan, absolutely. This is one of the most unique parts about the marijuana industry. This market already exists. However, it was untaxed, unregulated. There was no consumer product safety in place. And this is an industry today that is asking, if not begging, to be taxed and regulated. And there's not a lot of other industries would say that in the market. And we've seen $800 million in sales in the Colorado market, $90 million of tax revenue to the state level. They're making more money than they expected. Some of the markets have certainly, come online, have kind of sputtered a little bit as far as the rollout goes. But as these markets really start developing, I mean, the tax revenue is there for state governments. It's a huge boom for them. It's a product that needs to be regulated. It needs to be taxed. It needs to be done so for consumer protection. It needs to be done so to mitigate the economic damage of the previous black market, where dollars are going to criminal organizations, they're going out of the country, and there's no product safety. And then consumers and patients that legitimately have a use or a need for marijuana are having to buy that in the shadows, and the shame associated with that, and the risk of jail and incarceration, or even just some type of punitive damage, from society.
George, because you do publish information about the business, do you have any reason to suspect that large multinational companies, like the tobacco companies, are going to get into this business and sort of knock out the little guy?
Sure. And I think everybody in the industry recognizes the big three industries that everybody kind of has their eye on is pharmaceutical, alcohol, and tobacco. So while marijuana remains illegal on a federal level but is being legalized on a state level, really it's creating this unbelievable entrepreneurial opportunity in this industry.
That's George Jage, president of Marijuana Business Media. And yes, there is a book, The Marijuana Business Factbook 2015. George Jage, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Dan. It was a pleasure to be on today.
Up next, global warming, and later an incredible story. Sisters separated when adopted are together.
Stay with us on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
Missed your favorite news programs like 60 Minutes or the World News Roundup? Listen to those shows or hear something new like our newest program, Talking Animals. It's all available through our podcasts. Check them out at cbsnews.com/podcasts.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Once again, here's Dan Ravine.
New Coast Guard ensigns and their families got to enjoy a speech by the commander-in-chief at the commencement on Wednesday in Norfolk, Virginia. But the main subject was kind of a downer. Here's CBS News White House correspondent Pam Coulter.
Addressing the class of 15 at the Coast Guard Academy, the president warned climate change poses a serious threat to U.S. and global security.
Increase competition for resources and create the potential for mass migrations and new tensions. All of which is why the Pentagon calls climate change a threat multiplier.
He said the graduates who are heading to coastal areas from Massachusetts to Alaska will see the impact of climate change in places like Miami, Charleston, and Norfolk, where high tides and storms are routinely causing flooding. We can slow down the warming, he said, but time is running out. Pam Coulter, CBS News, The White House.
Now the president's orders to the Pentagon to stop supplying military-type equipment to police forces in the U.S. CBS News chief White House correspondent Major Garrett reported on that this past Monday.
Scenes of police dressed for battle in Ferguson, Missouri last summer provoked a national debate on the militarization of local police. This was President Obama in August.
There is a big difference between our military and our local law enforcement, and we don't want those lines blurred.
The president took steps to clarify those lines, issuing an executive order banning the Pentagon and other federal agencies from sending police departments surplus military hardware, like tank-treaded personnel carriers, grenade launchers, and even bayonets. The Pentagon shipped more than 6,500 bayonets to civilian law enforcement agencies over the last 2 years, and the Defense Department says that since 1991, police departments nationwide have received 175 grenade launchers and 101 personnel carriers with tank-like treads instead of wheels.
We've seen how militarized gear can sometimes give people a feeling like there's an occupying force as opposed to a force that's part of the community that's protecting them and serving them.
But most military surplus items will continue flowing, like mine-resistant personnel carriers used by police in the recent unrest in Baltimore. Police departments can still receive riot shields, long-range firearms, or night vision goggles. There are new rules. Law enforcement agencies requesting surplus gear will now have to announce their request publicly, explain how it will train its officers to use the military-style equipment, and comply with measures to track it.
That from CBS's Major Garrett at the White House. Now a history book written for teenagers. It's called Stonewall, Breaking Out in the Fight for Gay Rights. The author is Anne Bossom. You've become, well, an historian looking back to an event in New York City in 1969 that people who know about the fight for gay rights talk about Stonewall, and I guess we ought to know it really was a riot or a set of riots, correct?
This was a riot that was triggered by what should have been a routine police raid of a gay bar in 1969, and patrons of the bar, onlookers, the gathering community decided they'd had enough.
And if anyone wonders where was it, well, in Greenwich Village. In fact, let me just read this early in your book. The Stonewall Inn, which was a bar only, not a hotel despite its name, had a rough and tumble character from the time it opened in 1967. It stood on Christopher Street, a vibrant east-west corridor that cuts through the heart of the West Village. Its building had housed everything from a stable to a French bakery to a tea room to a burned-out restaurant before it debuted as a gay bar. And Anne, I guess we have to remember, this was the 1960s. I mean, a gay bar was something notorious, almost secretive.
By the late 60s, there was less illegality associated with a gay bar, but nonetheless a lot of infamy. And so this was a very different time than we've become accustomed to.
And looking at some successes, including decisions by judges, you write, it seemed the decades of death and denial and darkness were beginning to lift. Is the story over, or there's still a battle for gay rights?
I think that the fight for gay rights and other rights is part of the continuum of the human experience. And you've even got fights that vary from region to region in the country, where you have discrimination policies in some parts of the country against housing or employment, depending on your gender identity. So there are plenty of other fights to go.
That's Anne Bossom. You're the author of Stonewall, Breaking Out in the Fight for Gay Rights, aimed at young adult readers. Anne Bossom, thanks very much.
Thank you, Dan.
Let's end this weekend roundup with a story in New York City that's hard to believe. Sisters, ages 34 and 35, who were separated as babies when their mother gave them up for adoption, met in college. An amazing coincidence. Then they got together with their biological mom. CBS News correspondent Anna Werner had that story this past Monday.
Lizzie Valverde, Bachelor of Arts, Creative Writing.
Lizzie Valverde's graduation from Columbia University marked the end of years of study and the beginning of a new family.
Hi, guys.
Her mother and her sister joining her here together for the first time.
You've never been to a family event together before, have you?
No. We never even all met until yesterday.
That's because over 30 years ago, Leslie Parker, battling drug addiction after a troubled childhood, placed her two daughters up for adoption.
I was basically homeless
when I was pregnant with both these girls. And as much as I loved them and wanted to keep them, I knew it would be extremely selfish. And I couldn't offer them anything but love, but that's not enough to raise a child. It really isn't.
So sisters Lizzie Valverde and Katie Olson grew up in separate adoptive families. Valverde studied poetry.
You wanted me to show up to
Olson became a stand-up comic. It was in January of 2013 when both decided to go back to school and signed up for the same nonfiction writing class at Columbia as perfect strangers.
We were going around the table, and Lizzie said something about being adopted. There were a couple of details that all started to add up. The light bulb went off, and I had this big aha, like Oprah-style moment.
And you're looking at her with having this reaction. What are you thinking?
The first thing I said was, is this real life?
Valverde had previously found their mother and reunited the family just last night.
There was a lot of pride, a lot of sorrow, but a lot of happiness, too.
Why the sorrow?
Because I wasn't there to see them grow up.
What did the two of you get back when you found your mom?
I definitely got a sense that there's like a higher sort of power.
I got my fairy tale. It feels like a fairy tale.
They both now have degrees in creative writing and a tale of their own to tell, one that only sounds like fiction. Anna Werner, CBS News, New York.
Thanks for being with us, and anytime you want to hear us, please do a web search for CBS Weekend Roundup. You'll find our podcasts also on iTunes and other podcast services, and our app for your smartphone is CBS Radio News. I'm Dan Raviv. Bye.
You've been listening to the CBS News Weekend Roundup. The program is produced in the Washington Bureau of CBS News. The executive producer is Howard Arenstein.